Please call the next case.
Commonwealth versus Holland, Elizabeth K. Fitzgerald, Assistant Attorney General, Appellant's Counsel, Megan Shapiro, Senior Appellate Attorney, Appellee's Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
Thank you. The Court of Appeals erred by substituting its judgment for that of the fact finder and finding that Tanya Holland should have been permitted to withdraw her guilty plea. Viewed under the correct appellate standard of review, the trial court's judgment was supported by the record in this case.
But did the trial court in this case actually make findings of fact relative to the withdrawal issue?
Yes, Your Honor. Although those fact findings are not expressed on the record, the trial court is not required under this court's case in Fitzgerald to make particular fact findings. And I think it's significant here. Is there an echo? Is the court all right with the mic?
You're good.
Okay. Excuse me.
You're fine.
So, Your Honor, I think the clearest way to demonstrate that there are, in fact, fact findings and rulings on this record on each of the prongs of this test
is the denial of the motion.
Yes, Your Honor, and the fact that those arguments are preserved for appellate review. This defendant filed a written motion in which she argued all three of these things, orally argued all three of these arguments to the trial court, and then it was denied. Those arguments are preserved for appellate review precisely because the trial court ruled on all of them. And if the court does not agree that that's the case, the defendant's arguments in this case are waived under 525 for failure to get a ruling from the trial court. So respectfully, Your Honor, the Commonwealth.
Which one is it, though? I mean, no ruling under 5:25, or there was a ruling by virtue of the denial of the motion, or both?
Your Honor, the Commonwealth's position is there was a ruling consistent with this court's case law in construing Rule 525 and also with this court's preservation. It is a strange position for me to stand here and tell you that something was preserved, but I believe that it was. And because it's preserved, because there was a ruling on each of these grounds, then the trial court is entitled to deference from the appellate court as to each of the prongs of this test.
But before the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case, had this court or the Court of Appeals ever taken the position that the burden on any issue, whether bad faith or prejudice to the Commonwealth or any of the elements of allowing somebody to withdraw a guilty plea, didn't lie exclusively with the moving party?
No, Your Honor.
And in fact, there were cases that expressly said that, including the CAV panel decision in DeLuca, which I may be somewhat familiar with.
Yes, Your Honor. The CAV cases are, Court of Appeals cases are consistent with that. The defendant has the burden with regard to each of these prongs, this court as well, and Velasquez and others, consistent with the fact the defendant has the burden on this motion.
And despite Velasquez and this court adopting the CAV panel decision DeLuca verbatim, the Court of Appeals in this case ignored, went a different way and said, no, that's not the defendant's burden.
Yes, Your Honor, which
that's
is an
just
issue.
Wrong, isn't it?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I think there were several ways in which the standard of review were misapplied in this case.
Can we, under these circumstances, so assume all of that is correct, but can we say, yes, the Court of Appeals used the incorrect standard of review, shifted the burden in a way it should not have been shifted, but could we still find all of the elements present that would indicate that the motion to withdraw was appropriate and that it was an abuse of discretion to deny it?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, this record is sufficient for this court to affirm on the merits, applying the correct standard of review. And that would be applying factual deference to the trial court's conclusion that this motion was not brought in good faith.
When you say affirm, you mean the trial court, right?
It was pardon? Not a friendly question.
He's asking affirming the Court of Appeals, not affirming the trial court.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Would you like me to ask again?
Well, I think I understand the question. I believe I misheard you, but I would submit that if you were to apply the correct standard of review, the Court of Appeals judgment should be reversed because this court owes deference to the trial court, deference the Court of Appeals failed to pay.
My question was, could we do it on this record? Could we say, and when I say could we, would it be a legitimate judicial act for us to say, yes, the Court of Appeals used the wrong standard of review, but we're looking at the record independently, and we believe that Ms. Holland did put forward the right arguments in favor of withdrawal, and the trial court in this case abused its discretion in denying it? Or are we stuck?
So under Your Honor's hypothetical, just to make sure I'm understanding the question, is the court's question then, would it have to be remanded back to the Court of Appeals to apply a correct standard of review,
He's asking if the defendant can win with us on the abuse of discretion standard under the facts of the case, notwithstanding what the lower court said.
What he said.
He's asking, should you lose, I think is what he's asking.
Sure, no, I mean, I don't think that I should lose.
would there be any way where, given the hypothetical from Justice Mann, that we assume the Court of Appeals misapplied the standard of review, and with that assumption, is there any way for us to rule for Ms. Holland without us similarly misapplying the standard of review given the deference owed to the fact finder?
What he said.
Sure, and so I understood that one was friendly. Sure, I understood those to be asking the same question, but I was hesitating briefly because I thought the court was asking whether the court could essentially apply like a right result, wrong reason type of analysis, and I would submit that that only applies when we're talking about affirming the trial court. So that kind of the court's obligation to affirm on any basis in the record flows to the trial court's ruling, not this court's ruling.
Why don't you go through the variables on the Paris analysis and describe whether or not the trial court abused or didn't abuse its discretion under the proper standard?
Yes, Your Honor. So this court held in Paris and in subsequent cases that a defendant is required to bring a motion sustained by proofs to show that she's acting in good faith and that she has a reasonable defense. And then also in Small, this court held that if she reaches those two, then we have to weigh whether there's any offsetting prejudice to the Commonwealth and balance the equities there. But with regard to the first two, that she's acting in good faith and that she has a reasonable and non-dilatory defense, this record was sufficient for the trial court to find that she had not carried her burden to show she was acting in good faith. Good faith is, again, a factual finding entitled to the highest level of appellate deference. On this record, Tanya Holland proffered through counsel upon information and belief, which is what counsel put in his motion, upon information and belief, she believed that she had a plea agreement that would entitle her to no time, that she was never given the opportunity to view discovery, and that her lawyer had not gone through the elements of the offense with her. The first two of those three assertions are belied by statements made during the plea colloquy hearing, not admissions by the defendant relating to her guilt, which she is necessarily seeking to repudiate, as this court has recognized numerous times, but statements made by the trial court. The trial court told her that it was not bound by the guidelines in this case, and it advised her that she was facing up to 10 years of incarceration. Those statements undermine her later statement from trial counsel that she thought she had a plea agreement that would entitle her to no time. So certainly the court was allowed to consider that her first reason was not supported by the record in weighing her credibility. Her second reason, that she had never reviewed discovery. Her trial counsel noted in open court during that same hearing that the proffer of facts that were being submitted to the court were substantially similar to the police report, which they had received and gone through in discovery together. And again, her later statement that she had not received or gone through discovery is not supported by that plea colloquy. So seeing that the first two of her reasons were not supported by the record, certainly a reasonable trial judge could be skeptical as to the third reason.
What about her prior testimony at the bond hearing? How does that factor in?
Yes, Your Honor. The defendant in this case also had a fairly extensive bond hearing, at which time the Commonwealth brought the investigating police officer, Investigator Pace, to testify to the full kind of narrative of how this case evolved, of her interactions with the defendant in the hospital, also the social services agent and his investigation, the statements she made, when she made them, the type of obfuscation that was occurring regarding who had the medicine bottle and where it was and what amount was given. So the defendant here also, in addition to, we have counsel statement regarding discovery, but this defendant was present in court when the investigator...
Was the intent issue addressed at that hearing?
Yes, again, Your Honor, after that hearing, defense counsel said that if the Commonwealth was prepared to argue that she was acting intentionally, this defendant was going to vindicate her right at a jury trial, suggesting from the very beginning, from the bond hearing in this case, that her intention all along was to argue that she was acting accidentally and not intentionally, which is a defense that she claims is newly coined.
The timing of this, and there was an inordinate delay between the guilty plea and the what was to be the sentencing event. The passage of many, many months where if you have all of these things, one would presume you would bring it forward and seek to withdraw, but waiting until the day before the sentencing event, would that be sufficient to allow a rational fact finder to conclude bad faith?
I think it certainly weighs in the balance, Your Honor, and there are cases where a defendant has come forward very close to sentencing with good reasons, where there were other things in the record to demonstrate good faith. Again, this has to be a motion sustained by proofs. But where we have this timing, and we also have this defendant who has been on bond for the pendency of these proceedings, not only prior to her guilty plea, but also after it. So we have someone facing incarceration for the very first time, coming on the eve of sentencing, against this backdrop with the bond hearing and against this backdrop the statements have been made at the guilty plea, and saying then, suddenly I want to withdraw, suddenly I've received bad advice. And
can I focus just for a moment on the proofs issues? You've raised it appropriately. I just want to make sure that you're not, that it's not the Commonwealth's contention that proofs is the same thing as requiring a defendant to get on a stand and go through the various factors. It just seems to me that even though the burden is on the defendant, that would implicate Fifth Amendment issues, subject her to cross-examination to the extent that the motion was granted, it really could jeopardize her interests and rights. So again, are you suggesting that proofs would have to be either an affidavit authored by the defendant or testimony given by the defendant under oath? Or is there another way to do it?
Your Honor, whether a defendant would have to proceed in that manner, I think you could conceive of a situation where maybe we had other information.
Isn't that what happened, though? Wasn't it done by proffer?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that in this court's case law, in Justice, in Paris, in Bottoms, all of these cases did, in fact, involve affidavits from the defendant and did involve live testimony, and that would be a difficult choice for a criminal defendant to make. But as the person carrying the burden in this proceeding, this court has traditionally recognized that type of proof. I'm not saying it's required, but it's certainly notable that cases where the defendant prevailed were cases that did involve that kind of proof.
Given its resolution, it appears that the Court of Appeals not only thought that proffers were sufficient and that proof didn't mean proof, but that her proffers were in fact true and therefore to be credited and therefore they reached a result. The Commonwealth proffered that it suffered prejudice, did it not? That it would, that their witnesses had moved, passage of time, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The Court of Appeals, did it fact-finding on that one, too, and said no?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think it's significant, too, that the Court of Appeals analysis appears to be confusing a proffer with a stipulation. The defendant can make a proffer to the trial court, just like the Commonwealth could make a proffer, but the trial judge is not obligated to accept that proffer as true, to accept as credible those statements. This court has held in Black and Shackelford that even a non-testifying defendant's statements can be weighed by the court. But to Your Honor's specific point with regard to prejudice then, in a sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander type of situation, the Court of Appeals did go back and nitpick essentially the Commonwealth's assertion of prejudice in this case, which was the number of witnesses that they would need to call, the out-of-state witnesses, the investigator who was no longer in law enforcement, and the timing of these motions. And this is not the kind of prejudice that this court sometimes sees where there's a guilty plea where someone is deceased that would prevent the Commonwealth altogether from bringing a case back. But this court has never required the Commonwealth to be physically unable to proceed before its prejudice is weighed in the balance, in balancing the equities.
Counsel, with regard to your good faith analysis, you relied on the plea colloquy and the bond hearing. Doesn't Bottoms tell us that we can't legitimately rely on the plea colloquy when we're in a motion to withdraw a guilty plea? And if so, then are we left with the bond hearing?
Your Honor, what I think this court's case law establishes in Bottoms and going back to Justice is that when the defendant seeks to withdraw his guilty plea, he is necessarily seeking to repudiate his admission to guilt and certain other admissions, such as, you know, the viability of his defenses, things that are external to the judicial proceedings. And the Court of Appeals has recognized this in the context of 3A8C pleadings, where the Court of Appeals has allowed a defendant to do exactly what we're doing here, which is statements from the court stand on different footing than repudiating your admissions of guilt. Like, for example, you know, I'm pleading guilty because I am guilty. Of course, this was a no contest plea, but it's a similar function. But the court's holdings in Justice and the court's holdings in Bottoms do not foreclose entirely reliance on the plea colloquy.
It just means it can't be dispositive in all cases.
Chief, may I ask a question? I see the time's expired. Along those lines, if you had a defendant who was seeking to withdraw a guilty plea prior to sentencing, and one of the arguments was the guilty plea colloquy was not conducted appropriately to show the knowing and voluntary nature of my plea, if the rule was a hard and fast, nothing could be considered, wouldn't the defendant automatically lose every time because we couldn't consider the guilty plea colloquy that was allegedly defective?
Yes, Your Honor. It makes sense logically that some portions of these judicial proceedings are not, they're not pro forma, they're not without merit.
In habeas, the colloquy becomes dispositive. Yes. Here, it can't be dispositive.
Yes,
but it can be considered.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the difference is that in habeas, the colloquy binds the party. And in this case, we're looking at the colloquy and the differences to weigh the credibility of a later statement. We're not seeking to bind the defendant to her prior statement as we would in habeas. And again, we're talking about statements from the court here. The issue in this proceeding was this plea inadvised? And where the trial court gives advice, it's difficult to say that the plea was entered inadvisedly.
I'm specifically looking at whether she knew there was a defense. Are you aware of any defenses to this charge, or has your counsel advised you of defenses?
So, Your Honor, if I may.
Sure.
The Commonwealth did not rely on that colloquy response here because, again, that would kind of, as the Court of Appeals rationale in Pritchett goes, that analysis would assume facts that are not before the court in a way that the court statement regarding, that you're facing 10 years on this charge might. However, we can't view that statement in isolation the way that the Court of Appeals did. That one statement that she wasn't aware of the elements of the offense has to be viewed in context of her other assertions before the trial court, the timing of the plea, her bond status.
The question is whether a trial judge under the abuse of discretion standard could say, no, you were aware. Say what you want to say, but I've read the bond transcript. And then the question is, can we say that trial judge abused discretion, as opposed to whether or not we agree or disagree with it if we'd been the trial judge?
And as to the issue of good faith, whether that trial judge was plainly wrong, and there's no facts in the record that would support him. Because while overall we are looking at an abuse of discretion standard, the issue of good faith is factual, and there are facts in this record from which a reasonable trial judge could have concluded that she had not met her burden to move forward in this proceeding.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, you don't have any rebuttal time.
Good morning. May it please the court, Megan Shapiro on behalf of Ms. Holland here today. There's a reason that there is a liberal standard for trial courts to apply when someone moves to withdraw their guilty plea before the sentencing happens. And that's because at that early stage in the process, it's not that hard to undo what's been done and to fix something that has gone wrong. And that's what should have happened here. What this court has said and what has been upheld consistently for, I think, about 80 years, if not more, is this standard. Withdrawal should not be denied where it is in the least evident that the ends of justice will be served by permitting the withdrawal.
That very broad language in Parrish has been litigated and decided for a couple decades now.
Yes.
And almost every member of this court has written opinions on exactly that point. So these very broad, thematic, top-down points that you make still need to be filtered through our actual holdings. So why couldn't a trial judge in this situation say, I think there is prejudice, likely prejudice to the Commonwealth, because they had 17 witnesses waiting for trial and they were unsure whether they'd get them all back? I think this wasn't in good faith. She obviously knew there was a mens rea. She testified to not having it at the bond hearing. And this is just buyer's remorse. An experienced trial judge would see this a mile away. The day before the sentencing with new counsel, it's just buyer's remorse. So whether it's liberal or illiberal, that's the legal standard. And the question is whether or not we can say that this judge wearing that black robe abused discretion. That's just a tough standard.
To answer the first part of your question, yes, of course, a trial court could make those findings. But that didn't happen here.
Well, that's a different question. And you've got, honestly, you're going to have to push that sled up the hill slowly to make that happen, because we've said dozens and dozens and dozens of times that we do not impute from a judge's silence a negative inference on anything. We don't do it with juries. We don't do it with trial judges, and good trial judges know that. So, I saw the reference to affirming the consequence and consequent, and I actually the first thought that occurred to me is Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, the life of the law is not logic, it's experience. And trial judges are using experience in exactly this context, and all of us who are trial judges know that.
And when an appellate court reviews a trial court's decision for abuse of discretion, what it's asking is, was it reasonable? Could reasonable jurists have differed here? And on the facts, when there is not specific fact-finding from a trial court, the factual standard of review on appeal is viewing the facts in the light favorable to the prevailing party below and giving them the benefit of reasonable inferences from the evidence.
But if there are no factual findings that you have that this case brings to us or the Court of Appeals, then definitionally doesn't the appellant lose? Because how do I say that the factual finding was an abuse of discretion if you tell me, although clearly some was made, we just don't know what it is, I can't say that's wrong. If any of the ones are possible, and you tell me, well, there's no factual finding on this record, how can I say that whatever the court did was an abuse of discretion? Because he could have done anything.
It's not an unusual position at all for an appellate court to be in, to review facts in the record, to review evidence and information in a record in a light favorable to a party and grant to that party all reasonable inferences. That happens all the time on appeal.
So looking at this, if I look at the record and think, okay, the 10 months waiting till the day before sentencing, being on bond all the time, would support an explicit factual finding of bad faith. Just assume that. This record would have provided an adequate basis for a rational fact finder to conclude bad faith. The fact that he doesn't say, these are the reasons I'm denying the motion, where does that leave us on appeal?
Where it leaves this court on appeal is to look to the record and determine what reasonable inferences would be. And we disagree that that's a reasonable inference from
this
record.
But that's different than there are no factual findings for us to compare. That's different. That's saying that nobody could have ever concluded bad faith. Nobody could have ever concluded prejudice. That is an argument I think you're totally entitled to make on this record. Whether I agree with it or not, that's different. But if you're saying the absence of express factual findings means that you can't go in and say, well, there were reasons to deny the motion, then it seems to me the appellant necessarily is the party that loses in that circumstance, and I'm confident that's not where you want to be. I mean, if there's nothing for us to review, because he made no express factual findings, then you lose, right?
That sounds like the argument that the Commonwealth is making, that there would be a lack of, necessarily be a lack of preservation.
I don't think it's,
if there's not, I'm sorry.
I don't think it's preservation, but the appellant has an obligation to bring us a record on which we can rule on their legal question. If you're saying that we can't imply the factual findings, despite the fact that there's no requirement for him to make factual findings, what is there for us to review?
Again, the standard of review for facts is viewing the record in the light favorable to the Commonwealth here and granting them all reasonable inferences, and that is something this court does all the time.
Right, and if we do that and conclude that at least one of the elements that your client was required to demonstrate has not been demonstrated, or that a rational fact finder would have been within its discretion to find that she hadn't established a fact, that's just normal appellate review. That's not, you can't reach the question because no facts were found.
I believe I agree with that statement. And we're not arguing that the court can't reach the factual questions because no facts were found. We're arguing that there's no presumption of correctness assigned to any particular fact finding because there was no fact finding. On the burden of the defense here below to create a record and to seek rulings from the court, the Commonwealth has really overstated that. The requirement on a movement below is to give the trial court a fair opportunity to rule, and that happened here. The defense presented necessary facts and legal argument and got a ruling on their single motion, on their single legal request.
But the standard that we've used is the accused should be permitted to withdraw a plea of guilty entered inadvisedly when the application thereof is made in good faith and sustained by proofs. So the burden of proof, sustained by proof, is on the defendant. And the defendant here made an argument, didn't know what mens rea was, and the evidence suggested, yes, she did. She was sitting in the bond hearing. She heard the whole thing. The lawyer heard the whole thing, and they were both in the same room together. Why can't a reasonable fact finder just say, all right, well, I'm just not persuaded by this?
So two things. Proofs is not some specific form of evidence. A proffer, a unilateral avowal by counsel that's made and not contradicted by opposing counsel below, not objected to, is proof. And on the question of mens rea, what hasn't been mentioned yet here today, and it's a really important point, is that there's a big difference between the factual question of did I act accidentally? Did I do something accidentally as a layperson in my own mind? Or did I do something on purpose? Did I have knowledge that I was doing something wrong, or was I acting by accident?
Does the recklessness play into that, right? Because it's a little more fluid than just pure mistake versus deliberately on purpose.
Sure, and the legal question is, it really comes down to a level of knowledge, and recklessness can be one of the ways that that's satisfied, but that's a factual question for the jury, of course. And there's a big difference between what a defendant...
But it's a factual question for the judge to determine whether or not she sustained by proofs that she did not know that recklessness was the standard. How could she have possibly thought that? And why couldn't a fact finder wearing a robe say, you know, you got the burden of proof and I'm not persuaded?
There's a big difference between what may be testified to at a bond hearing where a defendant is talking about their version of events and what they believe to have happened and why they believe they should potentially be innocent, and the actual legal question of what's the element of the offense? What does it mean, first of all, that the Commonwealth has to prove specific elements? What are those elements here, willfulness, and what does that mean? And this court has made very clear what willfulness means in this context in Barrett, and then that has been adopted as a model jury instruction, and it couldn't be clearer that there's an element of knowledge here, and yes, recklessness can satisfy that element. But here, there is a real question of fact that should be brought to a jury as to whether that element was met. Even if, as and Ms. Holland has insisted from the start From the day that the event happened...
Can I stop you, though?
...that she acted in an accident. Yes, sir.
That's not the question, whether that element was met. That's a question for the jury at trial. The question at a withdrawal hearing is, did she know that that element needed to be met?
Yes, sir.
Not whether she wins on the issue or not. And she says, no, I didn't know that. And the trial judge says, I don't believe that. How could you not have known that?
And our position is that, viewed under the appropriate appellate standard, there's no presumption that the trial court found that fact
Can the fact finder reject the proffer? Can the fact finder say, I'm not convinced that what you have proffered is true?
Two points on that. So as to the proffer couldn't be rejected out of hand unless it was deemed inherently unreliable, I suppose. But the trial court can, of course, always assign a proffer whatever weight that it feels to be appropriate. And yes, credibility and many other considerations can play into that.
Then why doesn't that explain where we are?
On the question of a reasonable defense, however, we are talking about a prima facie burden on the defendant. And in that context, credibility is not appropriate to consider as to whether that has been met when the trial court is viewing that proffer.
Two questions I asked your opponent. I'd like to hear your response,
sir,
to. If you sought to withdraw a guilty plea prior to sentencing on the grounds that the colloquy does not establish that it was knowingly and voluntarily entered, would you be allowed to rely on the colloquy?
If that was a ground, and of course that's not the ground being alleged here,
I'm just asking conceptually.
I think that certain things from a colloquy probably can be considered. The Commonwealth is suggesting...
Can't the Commonwealth rely upon it? If the colloquy is relevant and material and a fact finder want to know, well, what happened at the colloquy? I want to know how specific the questions were. If you can rely upon it to make your case, why can't the Commonwealth rely upon it to make its case?
So just to be clear, the Commonwealth is suggesting that the Court of Appeals ruling in Pritchett is a good way to look at when a colloquy or how a colloquy should be considered. And I think that that's logically sound. I think that that's potentially a great idea for this court to adopt. The way that it's framed in Pritchett is that there's a difference between admissions that a defendant is making at a colloquy about things that are outside the knowledge or observation of the trial court in the room during the colloquy, which could be about guilt of an offense, or could be about, did your counsel advise you about the elements of the offense, which of course was not asked here. But if answers were given to those questions, those would be admissions, external information not happening in the court's presence, and those should not be appropriately considered under justice. And I understand the argument that, well, perhaps justice, this court's, and I mean the case justice, not the concept, that perhaps this court's ruling in justice does not foreclose consideration of these things, but just merely means that they don't get an outsized weight. We don't presume that they're correct. And I don't know the right answer there, but I can tell you that here there is one part of the colloquy that falls under Pritchett that would be even relevant to this consideration, and that has to do with the length of time of incarceration. The colloquy here is very short. The questions and answers are ambiguous, and there was no question about knowledge of the elements of the offense. There was no advisement by the court as to the elements of the offense.
But before the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case, had either of the state's appellate courts in a published decision said that the movant did not bear the burden on the prejudice question?
There is a lot of case law, and may I finish, Chief Justice, answering the question? Thank you. There is a lot of developed case law that by implication holds that when the Commonwealth doesn't make an argument or a particularized argument of prejudice, won't be considered.
But they did here.
Here they made a vague argument of prejudice.
Based on a proffer.
Even based on a proffer, which is perfectly fine. what it would be the movement's burden to do, I suggest a lot of case law developed from the Court of Appeals tells us, and I think that it's logically sound, is the, and what the Court of Appeals did in this case, is to say the movement may bear the ultimate burden to show that the balance of equities is still in their favor, and that did happen here, and there weren't any specific contrary findings to the contrary.
Well, it happened here where? In the Court of Appeals? They did the weighing?
No, there were arguments made in the trial court below about the balance of the equities.
But according
here.
To you, there's no indication that he ruled in your client's favor on the weighing of the equities.
The question is whether there could be reasonable inferences to the contrary. And here, this record doesn't provide for that.
Thank you. You've done a really nice job.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Please call the next case.
Commonwealth versus Carolino, Matthew J. Byrou, Assistant Attorney General.